All right, welcome back to the second half. Take it away, Lance. Come on now.
What are we taking away? What are our takeaways?
Where are we again?
Oh, yeah, we're at Can't Enjoy MN.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're having fun. Bob and Aaron are here.
Yeah.
We're just, we're talking about homegrown. We're talking about seeds. We're talking about smoke. And we're talking about eating.
Right? Mm. I haven't eaten any. But anyway, Bob, you were saying that you were surprised that the, somewhat surprised anyway, that the home growers are older. That is not at all surprising to me. It just isn't. But
you know, I felt initially that we're likely to have a younger audience.
Yeah.
And I think it was really a bad stigma. Home growers, you know, trying to look at the bigger picture, tend to be quite a bit older. It's often mid-40s is what we're seeing folks come into the store and start poking around. They've had those experiences at some point along in their life, and they're excited to come back to it.
But I think if you go, I think, and you've already sort of touched on this, but I think if you go to any gardening center,
yeah,
it's older people too. Like, there's just, you know, like, who has time to tend their garden? It goes back to what I was saying, is the kids are like, cool, so you guys are going to spend your time doing that. Can I just get a can? You know, like, they're just, like, all about the convenience, 100%.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, it's like, well, my daughter's at college now, so I'm taking her closet.
Oh, she's converting the closet.
That bedroom just turned into something else.
It's not the craft room anymore.
But now, does she have to do it in the closet anymore? Can't the weed come out of the closet?
That's true.
Is it because it's a good, dark space?
Well, it's an easy tent.
Yeah,
it's also an easy tent.
Depend on location too, you know. Oh. In Minnesota, I think one of the things that actually skews the home grow population older is, you know, along with 4 and 4 is the max or 8 in total, you have to do that in your primary residence. And so you can't go and rent a garden, you can't go and grow on your cousin's land or your friends or your uncles or whoever it is. They could grow their piece there, but as long as they live there. But that primary residence requirement is actually fairly restrictive for folks, in particular those individuals living in apartments.
Sure.
Right.
Because there, it's up to the landlord to say yay or nay, and they may even put additional requirements on you or extra costs if you chose to do that. And I think that in and of itself is going to skew a little older.
Isn't that just the thing you don't tell your landlord?
Well, exactly, because it's stigma. Like,
when is
asking,
that really what the like, path so, we want to walk down again?
Yeah. I know,
God,
right?
I don't know.
We don't want to, but also think about, I don't know that this is the requirement. I mean, rental laws is not my thing, but they generally are paying one utility. Right. And it's oftentimes not electric, but it's like heat or it's garbage or water or whatever it ends up being. But I mean, who's getting the notice? Right. Who's getting the notice about it if there's, you know, a spike in electricity and things like that? Because you're going to have a draw, an additional draw on some utilities when you're home growing.
Yeah. Is the modern stuff LED? Like, is it a lot more efficient than it used to be?
A lot.
Because it used to be really inefficient lighting, right? To get the type of light you needed.
But you're still running. You're still running that. Now you're running maybe a filter. It depends on how much you want to get into it, right?
Sure,
like you're running a fan and you're running a light. For sure you're doing those two
kind
things.
Kind of continuously.
Continuously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob can tell you more about those things, but there's filtration systems and there are some setups to this that you can get into, and just from what I've heard, you know, if you've got $100 electric bill, then you're probably gonna have a $200 electric bill.
Yeah.
You know?
Actually, it's fairly close for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so it might double your electric bill, which is
an extra $100.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, if it's $300, don't make it $600, but
right.
It was probably a bad
Gotcha. Anyways. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, like 100 to 200, but you know, if it was 200, maybe it's only 300.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100 extra is what you're saying for growing, and it's going to depend on the space and
of course,
you know,
yeah,
like,
I mean,
how big is this tent universal. And what do the lights look like? But you could assume about that, and then oftentimes what folks will do is they'll start calculating things, right? So say that they're getting gifted their home grow that they're not paying anything for. So those things, right? So they're buying it. And when they're buying it, they're paying this much for it. And then they go and they throw the calculation against home growing. And it's like, sure, I could understand that. But that person should probably still just keep buying it unless they actually have some care for the other
growing.
Piece of it. I think Bob's going to say so much different.
I'm going to say, boy, I don't know. You know, I think there's definitely a learning curve to it. Sure. I think for myself, it was a lot of learning to stop doing things and to find simplicity. There is many, many different methods to growing. And for some folks with their skills and their environment and their preferred genetics, those methods will be better for them than any other. And I also think that does not make that the same method, genetics, and skill combination for me or for you or for anyone else. And so it's find a simpler method, find a cheaper method, and there's lots of them. You know, at the very low end of cost, throw a couple seeds out in the garden.
I was going to ask if I could do that.
$30.
Yeah, because I plant tomatoes. 100%. I don't prune a lot of my stuff. I still get a bunch of tomatoes at the end of the year. I know I could get a whole bunch more if I understood my plants better, but I only need 30, 40 BLTs at the end of a summer to feel like I did the right thing with my life. Because BLTs are the best sandwich.
Absolutely.
If you grow your own tomatoes, that's the best you can possibly do is a fresh BLT. Am I correct?
I could not argue any different. I really couldn't. We're dumping tomatoes in our yard right now.
Right.
So we have a couple extra pounds hanging in the freezer.
Yeah. Yep. It's the end of the season. Mm-hmm. But I can just drop a few seeds in that same garden.
That's right.
And get some thing out of that, some product out of that that works.
So I started a photo period and learned in my garden this year that I have too much light at night. There's actually a street light literally behind us in the backyard.
Sure. Yep.
And I was like, with the neighbors' lights on and off all the time in the evening, I said, boy, this photo's got to go. So July 4th, I pulled it, well, 3rd maybe, and put a few autoflower seeds in. And they're almost now done early September, just under, they got maybe another week or so to go. And honestly, I think the harvest will be pretty solid on return.
Can you send me some pictures?
Oh, sure.
Send me some pictures so we can include them in this, because I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah, they're 2.5, 3 feet
tall. I picture.
Yeah, no, not at all.
I picture the ones out in the cornfield that everyone's like,
this
the,
big,
the FBI is flying
couple
over.
Branches,
like the pug of like shirt and salad.
The cost there was, I mean, there's, you know, I've got my beds and garden in general, but additional cost there was 3 seeds, they're $8 a piece. I mean, you can't literally get any cheaper than that. So 24 bucks, you're talking 6 ounces, 7 ounces. Probably coming off those 3 plants.
Yeah. I got more questions. I'm going to rapid fire off some questions here. So I've got my father's been in the hospital with multiple myeloma for a while. He's getting out today. So things are, you know, okay. But
good to hear.
Yeah, thanks. And I don't want to get deep into the, you know, his things, but there's a tendency within the cannabis world to sort of talk about this, I'm going to say this wrong, panacea, is that right?
Is that like the right entourage effect?
No, that like, panacea. The panacea of benefits, and it's going to fix everything, and you got this medical issue fixed, you got that one fixed, you got this one fixed, right? I know that that's not entirely true. But there is a tendency to talk about it that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm sitting there with my dad, and every hour or two, someone walks in that room and pulls out a million different pills and throws stuff at him. And I know that that's, he's been in medicine forever. I trust that they're not trying to kill him with that stuff, but I also don't know that it's not sometimes killing him too, right? So is there, in those situations, like there are we gonna open up tangible medical benefits now that they're rescheduling it or whatever, so we can figure out like what it actually does, what the plant itself actually does? Is that where we're headed?
I certainly hope so.
The research piece of that, right? So it doesn't have to leave people guessing or just thinking or just the sharing.
The anecdotal.
But to actually have tests and information to collect and then share that has been denied to all of us for a long period of time. It's right. really important now to start doing that research, because then you can say correlation isn't causation, but look at here is what we're seeing in these results. Yeah. And I think that continues to help with the destigmatization. I think that helps with just having those one-to-one conversations when your mom is the one telling you, like, hey, you should try this. Like, that is going to help you have trust in it because it's your mom telling you that.
Yeah.
And so those conversations all matter, and more research continues to be able to help that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I look at them and there's some, and I, you know, Dad, if you're listening, you're eating just fine. Everything's good. He hates when we try and put food in them. But, you know, when you see a person going through these, you know, cancer treatments, and there's a little bit of traditional chemo, there's some radiation, and there's some new stuff, some biologics that are, you know, biphasal, whatever. It's interesting stuff, but it has to sort of kill you to kill the cancer, but then you're surviving. And I wonder, like, okay, you're throwing all this stuff at them, but like, is there an edible product that I could give them that would make them less nauseous and make them want to eat a little bit more or something, you know, like that. I would like to know if these things, I'm not saying that you should say that there is.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, I'd like to know if those things would be out there, and hopefully in the future we get there.
I think they're going to get there. And with the studies that happen, right? Like, I'm going to completely make something up, but let's take THCV and say, all right, well, 125 milligrams of THCV is going to do this likely. Like, that'd be amazing to know, right? Because we start figuring out how all of these, we take all of these plants and we go, then this is great about it. And then we go and put it into a pill form. Let's take this plant and find out all of the cool things that it can do and go, all right, cool. CBD and THCV and CBG together is really good to do this. That's where we'll get to. That product then exists because those studies were done.
I mean, a lot
that's where we're headed.
A lot of medicines we take are plant derived anyway. They just cut this whole one out for some reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's actually one of the most exciting things coming out of rescheduling.
Good.
Is that clinical research, double blind, actual studies of what the combinations do to individuals are going to be allowed. Medical institutions for a long time now have not been able to put together studies with the exception of a few small areas and approval of the DEA.
Yeah.
And their compliance and potential, you know, involvement in being able to be part of Medicare, and for hospitals, that's really everything, was put in jeopardy. And so the clinical community has not been able to really engage with cannabis in a meaningful way in the last even 10 years of legality in other states. I think here in STOR, we've seen and heard in the last 6 months, several customers come in and talk about conversations between their primary care and themselves saying, hey, maybe consider your alcohol consumption a little bit differently. Maybe have you thought about this cannabis thing? And I think that is a really encouraging first start of advice from a clinician to something to consider. But I don't think that the level of clinical studies that really need to be done in order to turn those products into what we would consider a pharmaceutical grade at this time. I think we're moving in that direction. I think other countries around the world have moved that direction.
Yeah.
Certainly Israel, most of Europe, definitely Germany has really taken that kind of approach. And I think in some ways you really, because then that approach also leads to a methodology change. And it says the most repeatable process to the exact T in every input is what you want to do. And that almost always leads you towards some measure of hydroponics.
Yeah.
It leads folks to be feeling more comfortable knowing that they have to the milligram this amount of an ingredient getting to that plant. And I humbly come aside and say, you know what, there's other methods too. And they may not represent in that same kind of precision initially, but you're actually, you kind of can organically as well.
I mean, that
can be a both and, it doesn't have to be an either or.
Yeah.
And so when it's funny, people see that there's other options presented or available, then that gives that person that choice, which is more important than ever.
Yep.
And so I'm encouraged by the clinical component and the pharmaceutical methodology coming along, because I'm really excited about the research. I am a little concerned about their production methods. And, you know, I think as we learn and see as those markets change here and the economics of it in the United States over the next 20 years, I'm actually willing to bet some of those processes are going to change over.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, the clinical research is, it'll mature. The clinical research end, I think, is the most exciting part.
I mean, I do think it, sometimes I look at the way things work and I think it's kind of funny, because if you put a chemical into a little pill, right, then it becomes ultra trustworthy. If it's compressed into this little package, then it's, even though clearly these pills have been hyper detrimental to loads and loads of people because of overuse and misuse. But if you take, let's just take Tylenol, 250 milligrams, you put it in there, like, that works for everybody. Mm-hmm. Well, how could that possibly be? Because our bodies are different. We metabolize things differently. We're different sizes. But they're like, generally speaking, this is going to work for you. So if they do that same thing with weed, they'll kind of kill, with marijuana, that is, they'll kind of kill some of the stigma around it by putting it into a pill that looks like every other thing. But, you know, maybe, I don't know, I just hope they find, it seems like it would be nice for cannabis to stay, to not get so deep into all of the medical stuff too and get kind of ruined that way and still have a foothold in the natural remedy world, for me. But.
Well, you know, I actually think the cannabis industry is big enough for both.
Yeah.
And others as well.
Yeah,
I'm not a guy that likes monopolies. And so certainly one pathway or only one pathway is something I'm not a fan of.
Sure.
I think having room in the industry for everyone to play around in their own sandbox is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really do. And if, you know, we can learn more and more things from pharmaceutical companies that get interested, let's bring that knowledge out.
Okay.
Let's talk more about it. I guess I'm...
As long as they don't overprotect it and ruin the other
now
one.
That's a whole nother story,
right?
Yeah. Again, I started with, I don't like monopolies. I don't like businesses protecting their space in the way it's saying that you don't get to participate, whoever you are.
Right.
I've never been a fan of that in business.
No.
I haven't liked seeing others do it, and I certainly don't want us to as well. And I really am glad that Minnesota has taken a path that's different than that in the regulation that they put in place.
Yep.
And I say that because they're allowing micro licenses to be broad, a lot of participation in a potential vertically integrated area that you might be able to pick one piece up and start small and move into a second or a third. And that's not available in other states.
Right.
Not even a little bit.
Yeah, it feels like we're trying to do the right thing anyway. And hopefully we'll screw something up, but
we have to expect to do that, and that's why we always fail forward.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a great model, and when you have 24 other states that have the opportunity to turn, they can use Minnesota as a model, and then they can take pieces of it and then continue to make it better. Mm-hmm. So that'll be exciting to see in the years ahead.
Okay, question about the eight plants.
Mm-hmm.
The four in flower, four in veg, or whatever, right?
You got it.
God, I'm getting so good at this.
Doggy.
Okay, so, and I don't expect you to have an exact answer for this, but enforcement of that, generally speaking, is is enforcement of that something that happens sort of after the fact? You've gotten caught for something, and then they find you with 60 plants, and they're like, oh, you're not supposed to have, or are there agents out there looking for good, upstanding people who have too much stuff, and they're finding, you know, they're actively pursuing people overgrowing? I'm just curious.
Well, I don't know, right? That's certainly not something I've heard, that there's an active enforcement on home growers.
Right.
I do think that there is a certain point where you just become quasi-commercial. Like, I don't know what that number is, that you are no longer a home grower. I think the state might say 8. Number 9, you're no longer.
Yeah, they had to put a limit somewhere.
But I don't feel like 9. I mean, honestly, I'm not a very big fan of 4-and-4. I think 200 square feet or 100 square feet is a much better approach. By capping size and space, you cap yield. And what they're trying to do is do the same thing, cap yield through plant count. Yeah. And really, a tiny little plant that's a foot tall and a plant that's 9 feet tall,
right,
like that some folks picture in their mind, one is an ounce and one is a pound or 2 pounds or 5 pounds.
Right.
They're not even close to the same thing. And so I think some measure of acknowledgement there with being able to have small plants would be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And when we talk about wanting to expand genetics in the state to continue to
be innovative,
the innovation piece, like when you can do it by square foot versus just the number of plants, that can allow for pheno hunting without of it, like putting you into a black market again, where you can say, I do want, if I have 100 plants, I'm going to pick 2 of them, and then the other 100 are not going to be there. It's still in a vegetative state. We're not getting flower from it.
That was kind of why I asked the question, because it seems weird.
Square feet can be much more helpful to just keep people legal, but still get those genetics moving forward in the state.
Yeah, so I suppose the lawmakers had to figure out some way to put a limit of some sort, right?
Yeah, something.
But like, the speed limit's 30. I don't get pulled over for doing 34. Are there people out there getting nailed? They're like, oh, you should never have had that 9th plant. Like,
no. Well, I haven't heard of it.
I don't see it happening. But I think about like the seatbelt ticket, right? Like, you can get pulled over for the seatbelt, but you got busted for the weed. That's what it was back in the day.
Yeah.
And so I think still, it still happens now, but now they had to be at your house for something, right? And if you've got 9 flowering plants or 5-6 flowering plants that are visible in your backyard, well, you're asking for it. But outside of that, probably not running into, it's just the classic, you got to make the rule and you have to put a thing that says, hey, you're going to get in trouble if you do this. And then people will be good usually.
Mostly kind of abide by the spirit of it.
Within reason, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think the vast majority do. And I think... I agree. It is a lot of work.
Yeah. So to have 15 plants in flower is not going to be something that a home grower is wanting to probably do either.
It's a lot of equipment, a lot of time,
right?
A lot of resources in general.
Yeah.
I do think that lawmakers are not necessarily dug in on the nuance of the craft of growing cannabis.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And so 4-and-4 to a lot of people make a lot of sense, and I get that.
Yeah.
I do think we can come along and say, hey, we want to raise our hand and be like, you know, that's nice. This is a good start.
Right.
We can do better on this.
Right.
Right. Let's put our heads together. We could think about it. And keep the conversation focused on home growers. Because, you know, as soon as the conversation starts going towards what's the limit, that's often the expectation is that you're so far past it, you're really well into commercial range.
Yeah.
Where you're saying, well, you should just go get a commercial license.
Yeah.
Because you've got a warehouse of weed. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, follow the commercial stuff. If I've got a bedroom with 100 plants in it, it's still a 10x10 bedroom. It's not going to produce 100 plants at a pound. It's going to produce 100 plants at maybe an ounce. Maybe I'm just trying to get a nug off a plant.
Right.
just to understand how that genetic is. And is it something I'd want to keep?
You're like test
matching.
And I
think that's not allowed. It absolutely
At that point.
It's like drilling for oil.
Yeah.
You've got to plant a seed, roll the dice, and see how it turns out.
Yeah.
And more importantly, you got to keep a cutting and keep that healthy and keep it moving forward. And if you're able to do that, then you can test them all out and see which of those two out of the 100 you really want to keep. But right now, doing that at a 4-4 level is really hard.
Yeah, it's just, that's limiting the amount of research you can do on the plant itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, they might say, well, do that in a commercial setting. And it's like, well, I only need, a commercial license for 100 square feet.
Yeah.
Like, there's a mismatch then.
And how much is a commercial license?
Well, it depends on size there. Even the smallest at 500, on a license basis, that 500 sounds cheap, but the application to get there and the process to hold a non-residential property.
For the 5,000 square foot canopy micro license.
Okay. Yes.
And then 5,000 would be for the mezzo at 15,000 square feet for the canopy.
But then are there requirements around it, like in brewing, like getting your brewer's notes where you have like, can you tell us what your security is? Can you tell us, like, come on now. There's gotta be.
You get it. That's where I'm saying 500 sounds easy, but
no.
the categories that you need to include with pre-worked out plans is pretty extensive.
Right.
And it's a much harder hurdle and lift for folks. As I think we experienced with thousands that put a pre-approval in, but weren't necessarily able to put an application in because it was far more complicated than the actual growing of wheat.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's more than that little piece. So I do think in between commercial and 4-4, there's a better solution that can work for more and more people.
Yeah.
You know, especially keeping in mind the stop criminalizing cannabis. And to me, that's what happened a year and a half ago, is we stopped criminalizing cannabis, but did we?
Right, but all the way?
We didn't all the way.
Yeah.
No, right. Like we said, we needed to have a limit, right? We didn't say we could just let it go and, you know, work with commercial pieces being commercial. We said, we got to put a limit on this.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I understand that instinct to want to really limit folks in this, but I also...
12 o'clock curfew.
That's right. You know,
we gotta set a date.
You're just criminalizing cannabis again.
Right.
You're moving it. They're moving the bar, and that's fine. I think together we're just going to have to keep moving the bar.
Yeah.
And we'll find the right place.
Some of it has to go to the intent, too,
that
right?
That too.
Like, so if you have... If you have a small space with 100 plants and your intent is to find... two plants out that you love, right? That's different than I have 100 and I'm growing them all because I'm going to sell these illegally. Those are two different things.
But they're combining the same people in the same group.
Yeah, right.
They're criminalizing and recreating felonies around that. And, you know, I certainly don't want to encourage anyone to take a poor choice action, especially now that we have a legal option. I certainly work within it and stay within those bounds, but boy, am I disappointed
how
tight those bounds are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is why if there could be, thinking outside the box or thinking of what systems are already in place that could work of that, like what if there was a cottage industry of weed, just like your farmer's markets, where if you could make up to 75K in your household, or if two people, 150, you could grow it, test it, package it, go sell it at the farmer's market, or come here and say, hey, I have...
Yeah, there could be some way to
correct this. But if there was this happy medium of those two where you could give other people options without having to do a whole license and, you know, your security info, but then there still is something within a confine and in a realm. Like,
and
we have a great cottage industry in Minnesota.
Minnesota's cottage food industry is a perfect example of just everything Aaron said.
Yeah.
It really does represent... products that get to come from farm to customers.
Yep.
With the entire regulatory burden that comes with food production.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, what if your interest in this is more from the scientific horticultural end or whatever, and you're not even smoking it, nor are you selling
it. You just want the data.
But you're just trying to create a strain because you're interested in that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So... yeah, there could be ways that they could accommodate that type of stuff.
Ways to make it easier to operate without continuously criminalizing cannabis.
Yeah. Yep.
It's closer to...
criminalize criminal intent.
How about that?
You know, like if you're really out there to do harm in some way, well, that's something that we mm-hmm. need to manage. But if the intent is to find a strain, like, I don't know if that's a criminal activity.
It's pretty easy mm-hmm. to figure out if somebody's trying to do something that you don't want them to really be doing as far as the plant goes, right? Like, you're going to have pounds in the back from these plants. It's not a home grow. It's a commercial operation that happens to be in a home.
Yeah.
Like, there's these differences, and when you put that rule or that law or that regulation in its place, then you give some authority to an authority to say that was bad in your home.
Right.
When that is too much.
Right.
Right?
You did this wrong.
Yeah.
All right. One last question before we wrap this up.
Sounds lovely.
You, somewhere along, I may have been you, Aaron, I'm not sure. I don't remember who did it, but talked about a family practitioner or your family doc saying, hey, like, you know, I'm aware of the fact that you drink too much. Like, no one's fooling the doctor when they go in and the doctor's like, how much you drink every day? And they're like, oh, just two. And the doctor's like, mm-hmm, sure. Mm-hmm. My older brother's a doctor. He's like, multiply it by six every time. Anyway.
Every time.
You know, I think one of the stigmas that exists around the idea of these two things, alcohol and cannabis, would be that if like you're going California sober or whatever, right? But if you've got a problem with drinking, that if you then use cannabis, you're just supplanting this problem now with this new problem. And I think that from what I've seen, that's not necessarily true, right? What I think I've seen is that you can take something that is causing a lot of health problems for you and is maybe on a more destructive path and use the cannabis to kind of wean yourself away from it and feel better. But you're not necessarily giving yourself some other full-blown addiction over here in the process. Do you know anything about what I'm talking about? Like,
I think that cannabis represents that opportunity for a lot of folks. And, you know, I think that one, I hate to say, is really kind of personal, right? I know for myself, I tried quitting cigarettes, and I'm chewing nicotine gum 2 years later.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know for a lot of people, that's a 1 month thing. For me, it was different, yep. right? Mm-hmm. And I think that'll, again, kind of come down person to person and how they use that.
Have you
also
seen it
for
be helpful?
Myself, though, yeah. I've seen it be really helpful.
Yeah.
I have. And I, you know, again, I think that's, it's caution. It kind of one of the things you were mentioning earlier, that cannabis could become a panacea, a benefit for everyone in every way. I don't think that's the case, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it can do a lot of things, don't get me wrong. And often, even things that are overlooked, like, hey, just to keep it all simple, it helps reduce some stress and anxiety, at least for me.
Right.
Yeah. And I know alcohol does something similar, right? But that's coming at my body in a different way.
Yeah.
And it leaves a different impression as I go into tomorrow. And so for me, you know, even on those, what sometimes are not necessarily considered large, it's not a broken leg, it's not a heart attack,
yeah.
it's not curing cancer in the way that we think of traditionally. But I do think that stress particularly can have a huge and rippled effect on people.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's a hard one, right? Because
yeah.
I think it can be, and particularly that's where alcohol kind of finds this overlap. Like, it's just so stressful, I want to relax a minute. I want to stop thinking about all that problems.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes cannabis, you're just in it. You're even thinking about it more.
Right.
You know? And sometimes that can be helpful to sort those out.
Sure.
At least for myself.
Yeah.
Aaron, do you have
I've, you know, talking with people coming in, and I recently had a conversation with someone who is California sober, and they mentioned that, which is when you don't drink and then you decide to smoke, for people who don't know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That notion is like, they might have been completely sober for years, until they felt comfortable in their body enough to say, okay, I might introduce this, but I need to be in a good place before I do that. And so I think that's where that personal piece or people's own experiences, like they're finding where their boundaries and comfort levels are, and that there can still be a lot of judgment with California sober and totally. In that realm. But then they're finding their own community in some of that stigma as well, which can help with knowing that you're not alone.
Yep.
So I think that that piece where it's so personal and every body is different, but again, it could give a different option to at least get off of this hard thing first and then
the more detrimental of the two. Yeah, for sure.
A little bit of a brake pedal. It's like, yeah. Hey, I want to slow this down a little bit. Yeah. Maybe I'll try some cannabis.
Yeah. Not to equate them directly, but you know, if people are trying to get off heroin, they go on Narcan.
Methadone.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, and you know, not to say that that's exactly in any way the same, but yeah. I think from what I've seen, some people find a little bit of relief from the difficulty of getting away from alcohol mm-hmm. by using some small measure of cannabinoid product. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm.
sometimes yeah. I think with drinking, there might be that it can be to disconnect or like you want to get away from problems. Whereas with cannabis, it is going to put you in almost that present state and not this past present worry. And so when that cannabis experience, when you are in it, there can really be some healing that takes place in that process as well, where you are more in touch with your body or what you need. And then you can start making more of those decisions for yourself along the way, instead of that dissociation.
Yeah. I'm not sure alcohol heals much. I mean, it's good. I love it when I'm fishing. Fun. Don't get me wrong.
It's fantastic when you're fishing or cleaning a wound, right? Like, it's great. That is the way that I know for it to be healing, is it's antiseptic property of just pouring some on a wound. Not whiskey, but, you know, like proper cleaning alcohol.
Vodka.
Vodka will do it.
It's clear.
It is.
It's got to be good.
It's clear alcohol. That's fantastic. For sure good.
We've had some in our freezer for like 12 years that we haven't finished.
That's a long time for some vodka to sit in a freezer. We should rescue that vodka. Like we're going to rescue the Ark.
That doesn't happen at Sam's house.
Man, we can, yeah.
You can have all the alcohol that we just have sitting in the house that we haven't drank.
Aaron, Bob.
Yeah.
This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you both. Thank you. It was a great conversation and great questions. We love the curiosity.
What a lovely shop you've got. I'm glad you're doing this. And
thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Cheers.